Every time I've had friends or family come to visit, it's been with some reluctance that they've come initially, but they've always had their eyes open. I mean, they've always come away going, wow, I'm amazed. I had no idea. I think Russia is that kind of place. So I would really encourage, if you haven't been, to come and see it for yourself.
That was Tim Stanley, and this is episode 41 of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. Around here, I do risk, resilience, uncertainty, and randomness across all aspects of life, all domains, via long-form conversations with some very interesting guests. Thank you for joining me today and also for subscribing to the show. If you're a subscriber, I'm extremely grateful that you're here. And thanks to everyone who've liked, shared, or reviewed the show. It helps an awful lot. I started this show as an experiment. It's an exploration of risk and uncertainty, particularly outside of the corporate context where I work in my day job. And really, risk and uncertainty are things that we have to deal with no matter who we are, no matter where we are. It's a part of our lives. There's no escaping it. So we need to take risks intelligently. We need to be comfortable with uncertainty. We need to learn to become more resilient. And so in addition to entertaining and informing you, I hope that the show helps you and certainly helps me do all of that stuff just a little bit better. So on to today's episode, and today we go back to having a big picture conversation. And as a backdrop, I've been reading a little bit about or hearing a little bit about this concept of a low media diet or a low news diet or a no news diet. And what that is really you don't spend any or very little time on both the news and also on social media. And I think that this has potentially a number of benefits. On social media, you know, cutting back your time on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram means a little bit more time, a little less distraction, perhaps a little less thinking about what other people think of you. And so that's all great stuff. By reducing the amount of intake of news, it can make us a little less irritable, and it can also be something that is a little less divisive, because politics in particular can be very divisive and confrontational with our friends and family. And we're never likely to change anyone's minds, particularly on social media. I've tried to be careful on this show around sharing my own views. I have shared my views here and there, but this show is about honest and open discussion. And on that point, I also think that completely shutting down is counterproductive, particularly on the big issues of the day. And I think that this episode that I'm about to share with you demonstrates the importance of not only context and nuance, but also spending some time trying to get underneath the layers of things for a better understanding of a particular topic. And today's topic is something that's been in the news quite a lot, and that's Russia. Now, I grew up in or during the Cold War, and at the time, Russia, the Soviet Union, was the enemy. And it would appear that we're on the way to having Russia be the enemy once again. Now, I'm no fan of Donald Trump, but I do worry that there's a problem around the vilification of entire country. And as it just so happens, I've been listening to an episode of Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. Dan Carlin does these amazing, epic, very well-researched, meticulously researched historical podcasts episodes. And the latest one is called The Destroyer of Worlds. The Destroyer of Worlds comes from J. Robert Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer was, of course, one of the fathers of the atomic bomb. One of his remarks after the the successful test of the atomic bomb in 1945, when he quoted the Bhagavad Gita, "Now I am death, the destroyer of worlds." And the episode talks about the move into the nuclear age. And later in the episode, Carlin discusses how the world's scientists made appeals to global public opinion for greater understanding, for higher consciousness. And if we fast forward to today, you know, that nuclear threat actually hasn't gone away. And in thinking about all of this and thinking about the headlines that seem to dominate the news, the question I arrived at was, well, what does Russia want? And I know very little about Russia. I'm not an expert on the country, certainly by any stretch. But fortunately, my guest today is, and he's perfectly placed to help us answer this question. Tim Stanley he's a friend of mine and a former colleague. He currently works as the senior partner at Control Risks, senior partner for Russia and the Commonwealth of Independent States for Control Risks, which is an independent global risk consultancy. I've worked for Control Risks for a number of years as well. Tim is based in Moscow, and he's been based in Russia for 10 years. He's fully fluent in the language. He helps businesses manage the risks associated with working in the country. But Tim's interest in Russia goes beyond this. He lived in Russia in the early 1990s as a student. He arrived just a couple of weeks after the failed putsch of August 1991. And at the time, Russia was a country very much in a state of incredible transition. There was a lot going on in a very compressed timeline. He was there during the dissolution of the Soviet Union just a few months later, and he has a number of Russian friends that he's either kept in touch with or has recently or tracked down when he came back to the country. He came back to Russia in 2007 after living in the United States for a number of years. Tim's a Brit, by the way. And Tim has also been involved in election monitoring, human rights. He was a human rights observer in Central Asia and Africa. But he came back to Russia in 2007. And, you know, I think to really understand a country, you have to live there for an extended period of time. You have to speak the language. You have to try to understand the culture. And Tim absolutely has all of that. And he is in a wonderful position to provide us, and we're very fortunate for this, with a level of understanding of Russia that you'll find difficult to obtain anywhere else or from anyone else. And this is a great episode in which Tim shares what Russia was like in 1991 when he was there as a student, the transition that it underwent during the time of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And he's got some great stories during that era. He talks about the differences between Western and Russian culture, what brought him back to Russia in 2007, and some comparisons, Russia now versus back then in the early 1990s. He talks about what Russians think about Vladimir Putin, about the U.S., and Donald Trump, of course, myths and misconceptions that we have about the country, Russia-U.S. relations, as well as Russia-EU and Russia-China relations, and just a ton more. Tim's a great guy. He's very knowledgeable. I'm very grateful that he was able to join me and drop a bit of knowledge about Russia. And I think after listening to this, you will too. So let's meet Tim Stanley and let's learn a little bit about Russia. Enjoy. Tim, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on. And I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly, but Здравствуйте.
Not a bad effort, Ben. Okay. Здравствуйте to you great. Too. Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here, and I was honored to have been asked.
It's a pleasure to have you on, and I think it's timely, it's relevant, and you know, I always believe that to really understand a part of the world, you have to live there and kind of be absorbed in the culture and what's going on. And you know, you're based in Moscow, and this is I think this is going to be a fascinating conversation. So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
To kick things off, so you're a Brit based in Moscow, and you've been based in Russia for several years. So I guess my first question is, how does that happen?
Right. No, that's a very good question. It all seems to make sense when you sort of look back on it, but it's at the time, you know, you're never quite sure. So I basically started learning Russian at school, at high school. Back in the sort of 80s, when I was doing it, there was quite a large number of schools that, well, compared to today, that offered Russian language. Mm-hmm. A lot of the teachers who had done their national service had studied Russian in the military and then, you know, finished their 2 or 3 year commitment, gone into teaching and wanted to keep up the sort of the commitment. So a lot of, in that generation between the sort of 60s and 80s, a lot of the teachers were former military who'd studied it in the services. So I was lucky to be in one of those schools, and I, you know, was sort of fascinated by the opportunity. So ended up studying it at school, ended up studying it at university. When I graduated, it was just as the sort of Soviet Union was collapsing, well, a couple of years later. So I was working a bit with the sort of some of the newly independent states, but really didn't come back to sort of live here full time until the sort of the end of the last boom, really, which was around 2008. And I've sort of been here ever since.
Very cool. What you studied in England? So, did you travel to Russia? Did you always have sort of a fascination with the country?
Yeah, so I did. There were, you know, as still happen today, I think there are often school trips that are offered. Mm-hmm. I didn't manage to go on a school trip, so I was already studying the language for a number of years before I finally made a visit to Russia. That first visit was a month-long course in then Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, in sort of March to April 1991. And then I returned as part of my third year studies to spend the year in, I spent 6 months in Moscow from September 91 until January 92. So we arrived 2 weeks after the August putsch against Gorbachev. And then, you know, we'd arrived in the Soviet Union. By the time we left 6 months later, we were leaving a completely different country, the Russian Federation. So it was a fascinating time to be here.
Yeah, maybe we could dive into that a little bit. I read your article about things like traveling to Vladivostok for like $10, and it sounded like a crazy time. Could you just describe what that was like a little bit?
Yeah, look, it really was a strange and wonderful time in many ways, but a harrowing one, and we mustn't forget that for the local people who are living through it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a whole society and a whole civilization almost was collapsing, and people didn't really understand or know what was coming next. There was a kind of general, it's almost fair to say, a general apathy. I mean, you know, I genuinely believe that the Soviet Union, at least in its early stages, had done a number of things well, and they, you know, they industrialized the country, they sort of expanded healthcare and education and all those sort of things. But obviously they'd sort of lost the right to govern, you know, decades before the end came, frankly, through, you know, the sort of, they'd squandered the moral right. They just couldn't run the country anymore. It was clear that the system was collapsing. I think I wrote in the article that for a country that was covered in forests and trees, almost infinite amounts of forest coverage, and was a leading industrial proponent of the 20th century, for a country like that not to be able to produce toilet paper in sufficient quantities and get it to its market, you know, I think it had lost the right to rule any longer. So the system was collapsing. It was a very difficult time for people. For us, you know, we didn't know any better. We were students. We had dollars in our pockets. So we had, relatively speaking, we were much better off than most people. That said, you know, you would go to a restaurant that would be open. They would give you the menu, and then they'd sort of tell you there was no food, or, you know, the chef hadn't shown up to work. There were some sort of fast food joints just starting in Moscow at that time. So the famous McDonald's on Pushkin Square had already been open about 18 months. And I think there were a couple of sort of pizza expresses or pizza huts or something. But they would have two doors for entry. One would be if you were paying in hard currency, and one would be if you were paying in rubles. And the line outside the ruble queue, you know, outside the ruble payment door, they could stretch for hundreds of meters. It could take 2-3 hours to get in, but you could walk straight in to the hard currency payment door. So it was kind of an economic apartheid that was going on. The exchange rate, which had been more or less set for many years, started to go haywire. And so we were kind of able to exploit some of these issues. I use exploit in a very sort of generic way. You know, for example, the group that had preceded us the year before, even to leave Moscow, you needed a visa. So as a foreign student or a foreign traveler, you were very tightly controlled about how you could travel, where you could travel to. But those controls had all started to collapse. So we've suddenly discovered this. And with our sort of Soviet student cards, you know, we could just sort of waltz up to a ticket office, buy a ticket at a, you know, having exchanged dollars on the black market, so got massive amounts of rubles. And as you say, one of my friends ended up flying to Vladivostok, a sort of 8 or 9 hour flight from Moscow, a round trip for about $10. Jeez. And it was still a closed city at that time.
Wow.
So just the very fact that they were, the controls had completely collapsed and they would allow some foreign student to get on a plane and get in there was, you know, it was unprecedented. It was unheard of.
What fascinates me about that time is that, and I grew up during the Cold War, and the Soviet Union was this, you know, it was this supposedly, it was a scary place, and we worried about a nuclear winter and mutually assured destruction and this sort of thing. And, you know, no one really anticipated the collapse of the Eastern Bloc and, you know, then the Soviet Union. And I suppose it's easy to look back on it and in retrospect say, well, of course that was going to happen. But I don't, you know, I think at the time you're describing all of this, I'm not sure anyone really had a sense of what was really going on.
I think that's part of it. And I think there was an enormous amount, probably, of sort of groupthink. I mean, it was almost unthinkable, if we sort of cast our minds back, that the fact that one of the two great superpowers could pretty much overnight or over a period of, you know, months or a couple of short years could sort of could collapse and collapse largely in a non-violent way. I mean, notwithstanding sort of ethnic riots that were breaking out on the fringes of the empire. But I mean, I agree with you because it was kind of a black swan event. I mean, we didn't think in those terms then. I'm not aware that there was anybody sort of in, I don't know, in sort of national intelligence agencies or in academia or in think tanks or in businesses who were saying, well, actually, you know, the country's teetering, the empire is teetering, and it wouldn't take much of a sort of push to send it over the edge. I'm not sure. I'm not aware of anybody who was saying that.
No, I'm not aware of anyone either. And I think there's also a bit of an arrogance around understanding a place, particularly if you're not living there, that many think tanks and you know, people have. I think you said past is prologue in your article, which is so true. When you look at predictions or forecasts of just about anything, it's always you take the current situation as a baseline and it sort of goes slightly up or down based on where we are. And this was completely different.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing was that the nature of the society was such that it was very closed, that nobody, you didn't really get access to facts or to data. It was sort of operated on rumor and, you know, sort of the kind of the powers that be. You know, nobody, I don't think, had a, even going up into the Kremlin, I don't think anybody really had a firm and clear view about the state of the nation. You know, facts were fudged or, you know, data was sort of manipulated. And the nature of the society, such as it was that it was quite a sort of secretive place anyway. So that didn't help, obviously. But it does make you think what could be going on in sort of other more closed societies today.
That in we North Korea. Need to be, yeah.
Well, I know nothing about North Korea. But for example.
Yes, exactly. It's certainly interesting. I would have thought that really influenced your career choice in some way, to be in a place like that as dynamic and during that time.
Yeah, it did, Ben. I mean, it was, I have to say, I wasn't keen to rush back after I graduated. So I had like sort of another 18 months of study or whatever.
Right. Well, it sort of descended into this sort of, you know, gangster, you know, the Russian mafia. It sounds like you got out just before then, when it was kind of, it was a little bit more, a little calmer and tamer.
Exactly right. So the 90s, you know, people look back now on the 90s with shock and horror, I think, really, about how such a sort of controlled and calm and relatively predictable sort of place suddenly descended into this madcap world where, you know, sort of former rulers were now beggars, and, you know, the sort of the former criminal element had sort of were running massive business empires, and, you know, it was like Chicago in the 20s, that kind of environment. It became very dangerous very quickly. You couldn't get basic foodstuffs, or you could start getting these things, but you had to sort of spend a lot of money to do so. So society was sort of, the vacuum was filled with all the worst elements in a way of sort of gangster capitalism. So look, in retrospect, it would have been interesting to have been there. But at the time I was, you know, I just thought, it was hard work. I wasn't ready to come back. I had some friends who came back and managed to sort of pick up jobs. But on the whole, most people who came back in the 90s didn't end up staying that long. They stayed sort of 2 or 3 years. I think the pace was quite frantic.
Right.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah. And people were sort of, you know, would quickly burn out. But obviously, you know, having had this experience in the past, you sort of, it was formative in many ways. And, you know, both in terms of the friendships and the relationships you made. And, you know, when I look back now and see how the country has developed over a quarter of a century, which is what it is, to what it was back then, you know, I feel quite privileged to have sort of been along for the ride, or at least part of it.
Mm-hmm. And you studied Spanish as well. So I'm kind of curious as to why you've sort of veered towards Russia and away from Latin America. Was it partly because of this experience, or have you ever reflected on that?
No, it was just opportunities that arose, I think, after I graduated. Yeah. It wasn't necessarily a deliberately conscious act, but I was very keen to explore the sort of, you know, Latin America, as you say, and I managed to do that sort of through the company I was working for at the time, and so, you know, it just sort of it ended up at one point that I think for about 10 or 12 years I hadn't spoken a word of Russian, and I had been sort of following events from afar, if you like, but only as the sort of an armchair general sort of sitting there thinking, oh, that's interesting, or I wasn't really engaged, I wasn't in touch with what was going on in any way, shape or form.
Right. What brought you back?
So another career opportunity, really. I was living in New York working for my current employer, Control Risks. Russia was booming at this time. It was sort of 2006, 2007. You know, all the oil money was sort of being spent on infrastructure. People were rushing into the market, FMCG and natural resources and finance. And, you know, you could hardly open a newspaper without seeing another sort of amazing story about, you know, Russia's wealthiest men and what was going on domestically. And it sounded fascinating. And sort of on the strength of the Russian, which I admittedly hadn't spoken for about a decade, I was sort of offered the job to manage the sort of the London end of a corporate investigations practice dealing with Russia and the former Soviet Union. And I sort of, having thought I was going to stay in the US and started the process of my green card, I was slightly torn in terms of returning to London, but haven't regretted that decision for a moment.
Well, that's interesting. I'm wondering if you could just hang out there for a moment, because I think you're a little bit like me in a sense that I'm a Canadian living in London, and I've traveled to different places. And you were based in the United States. And so, I mean, getting a green card is not easy. And you were about to, did you get the green card, or you were about to?
I didn't know. We were in the process. We were in the process. Right. So I sort of, it was a, you know, a conscious effort to say, okay, I'm going to have to stop this process in order to move back to London.
Right. And take advantage of the opportunity that was presented.
Yeah.
What, so that, yeah, I can imagine that was quite difficult. Were you feeling like you were about to sort of get settled in the United States, or that you were, you know, part of American society and perhaps, I mean, was it a question of thinking about how did you make that decision, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
It was really difficult, and yeah. I remember almost feeling a sort of physical gut reaction, thinking, what am I doing? You know, I'd come over for grad school, so I'd sort of invested, you know, time, money, energy in sort of creating or, you know, recreating myself in a new country, if you like. And I just thought, is this, you know, are you doing the right thing? You're effectively throwing this away. I purchased an apartment, so I was a homeowner and all the rest of it. And yet I could just see that it was the pull of Russia, I suppose. Yeah. It was just the excitement of it, the interest in it. And that was, it sort of overcome my doubts, I guess. It was also a step up in terms of career. So there was a career opportunity, around it. And probably I think my thinking at the time was, well, I can always come back to the US. You know, I've got friends here, connections now, I've got a graduate degree, you know, it's going to be a lot easier next time around, if there is a next time around.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting, because I've been in those similar situations, and it's always, you know, I guess one of the questions to ask yourself is, if you don't take the opportunity in 2 or 3 years time, you know, are you going to have any regrets over it?
Your
calculus was, well, you know, I could always, yeah, the US will always be there, so
I might as well
take it and see what happens. Which is I'm fascinated by decision making as well. So this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's interesting how people make those types of decisions.
You know, and I remember reading an article once about people saying, you know, everyone's got their own sort of private board of directors.
Yeah.
You know, people you go to for advice and sort of insights that perhaps, you know, they know you well, or they understand you well. And sometimes, you know, having those conversations, you'll sort of get a flash of clarity and you'll go, well, yes, of course, this is obvious. And I'm sure I had a number of those conversations as well at the time. I had to think of a couple of them. It just seemed like too good an opportunity to pass up.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's sort of in life, you don't always get these opportunities coming out of nowhere.
No.
And I think you do need to sort of grasp them. Life is short.
Yeah. Yeah, no, very, I mean, it's very true. There are these moments where you kind of know that this is sort of a, I don't know if you call it, it's a fork in the road, a turning point, a decision point, that comes along rarely, but, it always makes sense to opt for, to me anyway, the option that will, that has the most sort of upside potentially.
And also, you know, also the option that sometimes sort of frightens you a bit and challenges you a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think, am I really doing the right thing? And you're sort of throwing yourself into it.
It's going to stretch you and challenge you. No, it's that's good. That's really good advice. So the place that you went back to was obviously very different from the place that you left. So I'm curious as to what you found when what surprised you when you came back. I mean, it certainly wasn't the place that with the queues and the fast food joints and the, you know, foreign exchange going ballistic, and the flight to Vladivostok probably went up in price.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, I remember that first trip back to Moscow after I can't even remember how long, a decade or so, and just how the city had been transformed. It was clean. The roads were good. The cars were all good quality Western cars. Mm-hmm. The air was a lot cleaner than it had been. People sort of dressed in a way that I would have considered much more normal, or just sort of more Westernized, or less, just in a less distinctive way, I suppose. Whereas obviously previously it had been much more limited and sort of more old fashioned and, you know, more Soviet. So superficially, you know, it was chalk and cheese. I mean, there was a complete difference. But then, you know, you'd get on the metro and you'd sort of the old sort of smells and noises would start coming back, or, you know, you'd sort of be, some of the sort of cityscapes around the, they've removed them all now, but around a lot of the metro stations, you used to get a lot of little stalls selling just about anything, frankly, any hour of day and night. And so, you know, you sort of get into the sort of markets a bit, and you kind of realize there was a lot of things that hadn't changed as well. And that was quite, that was nice to see as well. One of the things I did was I managed to track down some of my Russian friends from when I was a student. And you know how guys are, Ben, they're pretty bad at keeping in contact. And back in those days, you know, I think we'd exchanged the odd letter, but it was a real struggle. And, you know, then you start moving around a lot when you're early 20s and what have you. And we'd sort of lost contact. But when I came back, I made the sort of conscious effort that I wanted to trace a few of these guys. And, of course, the world of sort of online social media had arrived. So it was a relatively straightforward process, except for, two of my good friends whose names I remembered and cities I remembered, I couldn't find them at all. And it turned out they weren't on social media. But the one friend who I did find, he has the most sort of common Tatar name. He's from Tatarstan, Rinat Ibrahimov. Uh-huh. And, you know, there must be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Rinat Ibrahimovs in Kazan. But nevertheless, I managed to, he had a little photo on his profile. I knew immediately that was him. I wrote to him. I said, Rinat, you probably won't remember me. But he was like, oh, of course we remember Tim. He said, I'll be in Moscow in a few weeks on a business trip. And sort of, you know, so managed to trace people that way. And that, again, it was an amazing insight from, you know, how their lives had changed and the sort of adventures they had had during the sort of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the bandit 90s and then into sort of a more stable period into the 21st century.
What were some of the things that stood out? Did they sort of, I guess, have stable, relatively affluent lives at that point? I mean, what were some of the things?
They'd sort of eventually got there, I suppose. But you know, still, we'll be, you know, he tells stories, and sometimes he'll mention a story, and you say, oh, that was when I was, you know, fill in the blank, when I was sort of, I don't know, trading shares, or that's when I was sort of operating, heavy as a long distance lorry driver or something. You know, you just go, whoa, I'd forgotten that, or I never knew that. Or so, you know, they just sort of come out with these amazing stories sometimes. But they've sort of done very well for themselves. You know, they were bright, young people at the time of the collapse anyway. And so, they were probably part of the generation that was able to take advantage of the changes. So people probably our age and older were perhaps less able to, Ben, I'd say, because they'd sort of grown up in the Soviet system, and not everybody was able to sort of grasp the opportunities that this complete change in society brought them. So I think it tended to be the younger people, the people who had less to lose, who were able to sort of go with the flow a little bit. And, you know, as I say, one moment you're sort of trading stocks,
right,
and the next you're sort of a long distance lorry driver or whatever,
and then
the next
you're working on a drill rig or something.
Exactly. You're sort of used car salesman, or, you know, whatever it is. But you know, fascinating life experience. Thanks.
That's probably extremely valuable life experience. But as you say, on the flip side, you know, these people's parents, you know, it must have been a huge shock to them.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, some people were better able and sort of better equipped to deal with it, I think. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, look, there was a plus side as well. You see a lot of, none of these guys were from Moscow, but, you know, you see a lot of people in Moscow who were effectively, when the Soviet Union collapsed, you were given the apartment that you were living in, more or less.
Right.
So, you know, you have a whole generation of people who have, you know, they've inherited granny's apartment, which now is worth sort of, I don't know, potentially millions of dollars once you've done it up. Yes. You have no sort of mortgage worries at all.
Yes.
So, you know, people were able to capitalize on this to some degree. I mean, this is a vast generalization, of course, but there is a sort of middle class now in a way that there wasn't before.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And the amount of change that occurred in such a compressed period of time as well.
I think it makes people very resilient. And I think they, also quite sort of, and you see it today, quite sort of skeptical about planning for the long term.
Okay,
because,
You
know, well, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone the long term, you know?
Right.
I remember talking to one of the CEOs of one of the foreign investment banks here in Moscow, and he said, you know, a global investment bank, and he said that Russia is the only place out of all the countries they operate in, which is, you know, I don't know, 150 or whatever, where the pension scheme isn't subscribed. Nobody subscribes to the corporate pension scheme. And he was kind of like under pressure from his higher up saying, you know, you've got to get your people to do it. And he said they won't. They just don't see the point. They'd rather save money, buy an apartment or buy real estate or buy assets. Because then, you know, those sort of assets are tradable rather than the kind of promise of the nebulous promise of a pension in sort of 30, 40 years' time.
Yeah, it's a tough sell.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's fascinating stuff. I want to talk a little bit about Russian society, and we'll get into the sort of geopolitics and things like that. I did want to talk about that. But one of the things that made headlines here was this law decriminalizing domestic violence. And I guess, you know, in the where I'm sort of going with this is you have a society that certainly changed very rapidly, and in the last 20 years or so, it's been, you know, this huge amount of change and volatility. But at the same time, I suppose there are some values and things that perhaps haven't changed quite as quickly. Certainly, when you compare it to the West, sometimes, you know, this law obviously has been vilified in the West, and, you know, rightfully so. If you apply a Western lens to it, and you know, perhaps more broadly, but, you know, things like individual rights and freedoms and things that we kind of take for granted in the West are probably very different. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but I'm very keen to get your take on things like this.
Yeah, so look, that particular law, I think, is still going through Parliament, and I haven't been following it very closely. I have to say, what I've seen, I mean, you know, I think we're all right to be slightly horrified by it. The lawmaker who has introduced it to the Duma is slightly controversial and unhinged character anyway. And then, you know, it sort of begs the question about how real are the Duma's powers, and how much is it a real, fully functioning sort of debate chamber, or how much is it more of sort of an echo chamber? But I don't think it's a piece of legislation that has been pushed on to the Duma from the Kremlin or anything like that. I don't think it's a Kremlin project. Actually, from the little I've read, I think it's more influenced by the church, and the church, the Orthodox Church here, is a very, very strong and influential entity. It remains, I mean, the Orthodox Church remains a very, very conservative entity as well. It hasn't had the sort of social or liberal changes that we've seen in Western churches, for example. So it remained very traditional, you know, and I think there's an element there. I think the other element of it is more generally is the kind of contrast between the importance of the individual and the importance of the collective. I think we see time and time again, whatever it is in Russia, being a relatively conservative society, you know, that went straight out of sort of Tsar, God and Tsar, 400 years of God and Tsar, straight into sort of 80 years of Soviet-style communism, then a very brief period of the chaos that we were talking about before in the 90s, and has now reached a kind of stability and an equilibrium point, trying to take the best out of these periods. But it's never really had a long, sustained period of you know, sort of social dynamics or social dialogue, or people trying to, you know, constituent members of society debating how they want to be and what kind of a society they want to be. They've sort of missed all that, I think it's fair to say, in a way that, you know, in the West, we've had hundreds of years of democracy, greater, you know, to a greater or lesser extent. We've sort of, our societies have changed quite slowly as well. And if you look at the sort of the gay the sort of anti-gay promotion laws in Russia as well. It's a very similar law to the one that was in Britain that Mrs. Thatcher introduced back in the 1980s. So it's about promotion. So, you know, societies sort of reach their... I suppose they have to decide these things for themselves on the basis of internal dialogue. But I think the fundamental thing is the difference between the collective and the individual. And I think in the West, we are very individualist societies on the whole. So the individual is the most important, and the sort of the individual, the smaller individual unit is more important than the greater collective good of sort of whatever that may be, state, God, religion, you know, the army, whatever it is. And in Russia, that balance comes down very firmly, I think, towards the collective. And you see it, it's a very silly example, but I remember somebody pointed out to me, you know, if you're in London and New York, if you're on the subway or walking down the street, people are walking at a speed that suggests, you know, I'm the most important person in the world. I've got to get to my next place. It's really critically important. You don't really see that so much in Moscow because I think there's a sense that, well, so, you know, if I'm late, I'm late. It's not the end of the world.
Right.
I'll get there. We'll still have the conversation.
Yes.
Or somebody else will pick up the pieces for me or, you know, cover for me or whatever it is.
Yes.
So I just think there's a – that's the fundamental discrepancy, I think, but that people don't often see between what Russia is and the West is. And I'm sure it's not only Russia that has that. I mean, I think, a lot of East Asian societies have a similar dynamic.
Absolutely. I lived in South Korea for a while, and it is absolutely the same type of dynamic in terms of, I mean, there's some fundamental differences around Confucianism and things like this, but the collective versus the individual, I mean, is a hugely, it's a society that very much falls on the collective. Just in terms of bureaucracy, you talked about things being slower, and I immediately thought of bureaucracy. I remember being in Poland in the late 1990s, and there were a few shops that had sort of this sort of Soviet era type of or Eastern Bloc era type of dynamic to them. You'd go in, everything would be behind the counter, and you'd have to tell this sort of elderly shopkeeper, you know, what you want, or point or grunt, as I did, and then he'll sort of pull the stuff out off the shelves.
So there used to still be a few of those shops around Moscow. I don't think you see them anymore, but you used to have to go in, you'd say, I want something, point it or explain what it is. You would get a ticket. You then take that ticket to the cashier to pay for it. The cashier would give you a receipt, and then you'd go back to either to a third desk or to the original desk, say, here's my receipt for my goods, and only at that point would you get them handed over. Just a nightmare.
And I'm just wondering, you know, the legacy of all that bureaucracy, because some of that is just like creating jobs for people, right? So the person is, you know, stamps this paper and then moves it on to somebody else. I mean, I would have thought anyway. Is there an overhang of that in the, you know, doing business in Russia, or just getting, you know, getting your driver's license or things of that nature?
So, I mean, absolutely, yes, is the short answer. A lot of the sort of the government services have become much easier and more efficient, and the interface is a more efficient process. But I think, you know, fundamentally, the sort of the way to conduct business, it just follows a completely different logic in terms of sort of contracting and responsibilities. And, you know, there's still the Russian accounting system, for example. Now, most big, you know, international Russian companies will report in international IFRS as well as Russian. But if you're a domestic company, you're probably just operating under the Russian accounting system, which is very different from IFRS. So the whole sort of logic and the whole, you know, a lot of these concepts are very different. I think I'm right in saying that the concept of accruals doesn't exist under the Russian accounting system, for example. So you end up with two fundamentally different systems sort of rubbing alongside each other and trying to operate together, I suppose. But yeah, I worked at one of the big four for 3 years here in Moscow, and that was where the conflict was most. You know, you had the massive bureaucratic structures of an international audit company, and they would sort of cut. You know, it was like I don't know, Tarzan was all sort of what's the name of that big Japanese monster? Godzilla versus whoever, you know, would come up, clash up against the sort of Soviet bureaucratic system, you know, and it was like, who's going to give first and give and take and, constantly, you know, documents. The importance that is invested in a document only goes so far as, does it have a signature and a stamp on it?
Right.
And the content could be complete gobbledygook half the time. But if it's got a stamp and a signature on, fine, it's all appropriate and above board, and we can make that payment or whatever it is.
Right.
So there's a lot of sort of substance put into these sort of superficial areas, if you like, rather than understanding what's really going on.
Yeah. I'd like to come back to that, but I also wanted to dive into the world of politics and geopolitics a little bit. I know that there's a lot in the Western media that's been made about Putin and Trump and the future relationship and things of that nature. But I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about that. And I guess first and foremost is just the standing that Putin has internally. And you know, what is that like? I mean, I'm everything I've read seems to suggest he enjoys a high level of support. I'm wondering what's the feel like when you're in the country.
Yeah, there's no question he is very popular by any measure.
Yeah.
Just about, and sure, the popularity ratings go up and down, but I don't think they drop below about 60%.
Right.
And you know, I think that's a genuine reflection. I don't think that's a sort of sleight of hand or manipulation by the Kremlin. I think that is genuine. You know, people respect him because they have this memory of the chaos that was in the country before he arrived. Up until, you know, under Yeltsin, who was an alcoholic, a very, you know, not even a functioning alcoholic, frankly, and was being influenced by, you know, sort of economists and politicians and people from the West in a way that Russians believe today didn't favor Russia. So, look, he is genuinely popular. That doesn't mean that you can't make jokes about him. That doesn't mean there are not memes about him on the internet constantly. I mean, he is a very prominent figure. I don't think it's a cult of personality. I don't think it's anything like that. I think people, you know, people genuinely respect him. And I have to say, when you listen to him, when you watch him on TV, when he does these sort of 4-hour-long press conferences, he's a very, very engaging and intelligent individual. In a way, I mean, I hate to say it, but that a lot of our politicians, we've kind of lost that. Now, it's easier for him in a way because he doesn't have to worry so much about opposition. He doesn't really have to worry about sort of the latest opinion polls and, you know, the latest scandal about to break on TV and react to all that. And he has, by this stage, had the luxury of a long period in power. So he is the expert on how to run a country like Russia. But there's no sense that I get that he's coasting. There's no sense that I get that people are sort of sick and tired of him. And there's no sense either that there's any obvious alternative.
Right. I was going to ask you about that in terms of the opposition. Because the things that you hear, I mean, there was a wonderful conversation I listened to between Sam Harris and Garry Kasparov, who is obviously anti Putin, and I'm curious. So what Kasparov was saying that Putin's worldview is inherently a dark one, that is, whereas he's not making any excuses for the Soviet Union, but there was a kind of a future element, a humanist element of the Soviet Union to make, you know, society better, and the criticism that Kasparov is what he's saying is that it's sort of a medieval worldview where that vision doesn't exist, that it's just about, you know, consolidation of power, expansion of power for the sake of power. I'm curious what you make of that, how widely shared that view might be, or whether we're missing something about Putin, that there's there is a vision that there is a worldview that he has that somehow is driving his actions and driving his support, but also leads to a place where the West and Russia can cooperate. So a very long-winded preamble to a question, but
the opposition is weak and fractured. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. Putin's vision, I think, has always been to have respect restored to Russia.
Mm.
Broadly speaking, and right, I think he's managed right. to do that on right. his own terms.
Right. Right.
And I think that's been important for him. And I think, to the extent that a leader reflects the interests and concerns of their people, mm-hmm. then I think he's been quite successful in that. Mm-hmm. I think there is a sense that, Russia's back up off its knees, mm-hmm. that it is a country that needs to be taken seriously, that its worldview, its civilization, Russia likes to think of itself as a civilization, is very different from the West,
mm-hmm.
And proud to be so, mm-hmm. and is not going to try and sort of become just like another Western or sort of liberal European country. That's
okay.
not what most Russians are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that. I would say also, given the size of the country, and I know there are other big countries out there, Canada, the US, or whatever, it's not easy to manage a country this size. And I think, there probably is a sort of deep-seated concern that, okay, if we start letting regions do their own thing or giving them too much latitude to make decisions, that's the start of a slippery slope to independence movements or greater autonomy, and potentially ultimately the breakup of the country. Which again is something I think most people don't want to see, sorts of strategic, historical, cultural.
Sure, reasons. Sure. Well, I suppose because perhaps of those historical and cultural reasons, is that a sort of a pervasive fear that dominates the political debate or people's thinking in places like Moscow?
I think it's implicit. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's explicit. People mm-hmm. don't talk about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, there is a kind of existential concern about the sort of 1.6 billion Chinese on one side of an artificial line or a river, and then, absolutely sparsely populated, rich sort of virgin forests, lands, and water, and all sorts of natural resources on the other side.
Mm.
And you do occasionally see stories where a couple of governors, I think, out in the Far East have introduced legislation allowing long-term leases by Chinese companies. And that, that has sparked a huge amount of debate locally about this is the thin end of the wedge, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And once these people arrive, they will never go home. There's definitely a sort of a nationalist and a sort of nasty, if you like, ethical tinge to that. But I think it is part of that deep-seated concern that, we've got this enormous country and we're very, very thinly populated. Mm-hmm. It'd be very difficult to defend if a concerted attempt were made to sort of declare UDI or to invade or mm-hmm. whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So I think that's deep in the psyche, but it's definitely there.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense when you look at the history. On both the on all the borders, right? So there's certainly an element of historical validity to it, and it's important to understand that.
They've lost one empire is the way they would think about it. The Soviet Union collapsed.
Yes.
The Soviet Union was an artificial construct, but
yes.
It brought an awful lot of sort of building, infrastructure, education, healthcare across vast areas of sort of Central Asia and European Russia as well.
Yes.
So it wasn't all a force for bad that I think we see it as
right.
now
right.
from the West.
Well, I suppose... And the flip side of that is that there's a whole bunch of potentially, I would have thought, some irredentism around reclaiming territories that are quote unquote ours. Mm-hmm. Crimea obviously being the chief example, but I presume there are others, and that that I suppose that sentiment whether it comes from the politicians, from Putin, or the populace, creates a huge amount of instability in a number of regions.
So I think actually the Crimea is the exception that proves the rule there.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, because look, there is clearly a kind of neo-McCarthyite sort of thing going on in the West right now about the Russians are coming, they're, you know, they're sort of changing our elections, they're about to invade the Baltics and Poland, you know.
Yes.
I think 99% of that is hype. I really do. There is no reason why Russia would want to invade the Baltics or Poland. It's been a bit of a relief, I think, in many ways for Russia to sort of step back from that part of the world where they were hated, let's be honest, really not respected, disliked, seen as invaders, occupiers, bullies. And you know, there are historical reasons why that is so, to be fair. But the idea that Russia's itching to sort of move back into the Baltics is madness. I think it's a complete fallacy. And I think it benefits certain actors in the West more than it's more than it reflects any kind of Russian reality.
Right.
I don't think, you know, I think the sort of the independence of Central Asian states, that's a given now. I don't think there's any great desire to sort of, there may be the sort of the economic and the Eurasian trade area, a sort of idea to create a common economic space that would include Belarus and Kazakhstan and other parts. But I think that's in contrast to the EU and NATO. I don't think that's an empire building project by any stretch of the imagination.
What's your take on Russia-U.S. relations, given President Trump? What's your view on where that, you know, and who knows, right? Is the answer? But
it is. That's the answer to anything involving Trump.
Yes,
I think.
Yeah.
So look, when I think there was genuine relief when Clinton was not elected president. Clinton was seen as part of the problem. And the people who surrounded her were seen as part of the problem. So
why is that?
It's really interesting. The Soviets always said it was much easier doing business with the Republicans than with the Democrats. I think the Democrats are seen as more inflexible, more ideological, more sort of shrill in terms of expectations, or, you know, this is the way we want you to behave, raising awkward issues like human rights and all these other things. And whereas I think the Republicans have always been seen as more flexible, more transactional, more willing to focus on areas of commonality rather than sort of, you know, being scolding partners and saying, we want you to do this, we want you to do that. So and certainly, you know, when she was Secretary of State, she did no favors. A lot of her rhetoric, and during the campaign, her rhetoric was incredibly anti-Russian. So I think there was a huge relief when she was not elected. I think a lot of these stories about Trump's sort of Russian influence and backers, and does the KGB or the FSB have sort of have dirt on him, I think a lot of that is utter nonsense. I think he's, you know, he has made a few statements saying, look, this is crazy. It is the biggest country in the world. We do have areas of commonality where we have common interests. We need to focus on those, not focus on the differences. So I think there is going to be a more pragmatic approach to the relationship. That said, I still think there's a bit of nervousness in the Kremlin.
Yes.
Because no one really knows.
Yes.
You know, the guy is quite volatile.
Yes.
And he says one thing today, and then he tweets something else late at night, and then says something completely different at the press conference the next day.
Yes.
So, you know, that's not the Russians play a long game. You know, they're strategic thinkers. They're chess players, right? They don't, you know, they will be thinking several moves ahead. And this is why I think in the telephone call that took place between them over the weekend, I think I'm right in saying there was no mention of sanctions. It just wasn't an issue for discussion. They focused on areas where they could cooperate. And in the Russian, you know, from the Kremlin's point of view, sanctions is not their issue. It's something that they're not going to go begging, saying, please remove sanctions, please remove sanctions. That's something that the West needs to move on, not Russia. So I think I wouldn't even say cautiously optimistic, but I think there is an expectation that things, that the relationship will improve. To be fair, it couldn't have got much worse.
Mm. Yeah, that's it's interesting to hear you hear you say that. I mean, when you say things like human rights, right? It's well, obviously human rights are something, you know, that that people in the West typically hold dearly, but I suppose has a different connotation in Russia.
And there's also a double standard as well, I think, because, you know, perhaps correctly, people will hold Russia to a different standard than they will to many other countries there. Mm. People are more than willing to do business with or to cooperate with. Mm-hmm. So I think Russia as well feels that hypocrisy quite keenly.
Right. So things like doing business with the Saudis and things.
And the Chinese.
Like, and the Chinese and, you know, and people that violate human rights.
Exactly.
Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Understood. And that does make a lot of sense. If you're looking at it from that vantage point, there are double standards in global politics.
Yeah.
Curious about so perhaps just an extension of this, but Russia-EU relations, and there's a lot of there's a lot of nervousness now after Brexit, and we have these elections coming up in, you know, France and Germany later in the year, and again you hear these things, or you see these headlines or these commentaries in Western publications around, well, you know, Putin just wants the disintegration of the EU. And, you know, they will interfere in some of these elections, and, you know, Brexit is probably one of the best things that Putin one of the best things for Russia. I'm curious because I really think there's more nuance than that. But
Look, I think short term, mm-hmm. I think short term the Kremlin sort of sees the turmoil that the EU is in and sees opportunities to pick off countries one by one and sort of do one to one deals rather than 1-27 or 29 deals or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I think in some ways that might be easier. That might be to their advantage.
Right.
But I think longer term, you know, it's not in Russia's interest to have an unstable Western border.
Sure.
I think they would much rather have a stable and fully functioning entity that they could deal with. You know, it's not just Russians, by the way, who find it difficult to understand, you know, who do we call in Brussels when there's a problem? I can't remember, it was Kissinger or whoever it was came out with that famous, you know, who's my point of contact?
Yes.
There's three people in Brussels I should be calling.
Yes.
There's also the national leaders.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's a work in progress, Europe, yes. I get that. Yes. But it's clearly at a critical juncture. And whether organizations of that scale and scope are able to sort of self-renew, I don't know. It's an open question. So, look, again, I think Russia's probably looking several steps ahead. Mm-hmm. They're sort of taking a lot of the flack that's being presented about them. They're dismissing it as nonsense, and I think a lot of it is. I think a lot of it is related to a sort of slightly hysterical take. Let's look outside ourselves to find an axis of blame, rather than looking within ourselves find an axis of blame. And, you know, Russia sort of rather well steps up to the plate as a sort of screen baddie. You know?
Yes, yes. One of the things that one reads about is that what Russia's really looking for is this Yalta 2, right? So I guess Yalta 1 was 1943 or something like that, I think it was, where, you know, the Western powers and the Soviet Union sat down and kind of came up with this concept of spheres of influence, and you sort of read that, well, what Putin wants is exactly the same thing for the 21st century, some type of agreement to extend or to have these spheres of influence in and around its borders, I suppose, for security. Is that something that you would is that a viewpoint that you'd share in terms of objectives of Russia?
Mm-hmm. I think there is a lot to that, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, Russia's point of view is always based on realpolitik.
Yes.
It was one of the superpowers, and it's not easy to go from being, as Britain knows, to going from being a superpower one day to being a sort of a regional power the next. You know, Russia's point of view is that it was extending the hand of friendship and cooperation. It's been talking about, you know, a common trade and security space from Lisbon to Vladivostok. This was sort of 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. It was, you know, Putin was famously the first foreign leader to call George Bush after 9/11. They explicitly extended support to the operations in Afghanistan, for example. They did not kick up a fuss when the EU and NATO expanded into sort of former Warsaw Pact countries or into, you know, even former Soviet republics, despite what they perceived to have been a promise that was broken during German reunification that NATO would expand no further east. And then, you know, so from the Russian point of view, it's been slight after slight after slight. The the unilateral scrapping of the anti-ballistic missile treaty by the US in December 2001, you know, which maintained, that restored the balance in the European and the Eurasian landmass. Again, just Russia's concerns were completely disregarded. So, you know, any country has legitimate security concerns. Russia feels it's, for a decade and a half now, its legitimate security concerns have been ignored. And now I think it's it feels, with sort of relative, I don't know if you can call anything in Syria a success, but a sort of relative stability, and, you know, the fact that the Russians were instrumental in getting the chemical weapons removed from Syria. The Russians have been instrumental in this most recent ceasefire in Syria that has now allowed the parties to come together in Astana and Kazakhstan to at least start talking about what a final solution might look like. They're still a long way from it, but they've been instrumental in that. So I think they are feeling, or the Kremlin is feeling, a bit more confident that, yes, Iran as well. The Iran deal could not have been done without Russian support. So I think there is a sort of feeling that, you know, we've sort of fought our way back to the top table again, and we need to be taken seriously. Whether they can sustain that in the long run, whether there's sufficient interest, financial resources to try and make sure this stability continues in the long run, I don't know. But I think certainly they've through sort of diplomatic, you know, wiles, through investment into, you know, supporting people like Assad, who was or at least the Syrian government, which was they've been a long-term backer of, but also doing deals with countries they've been in conflict with, like the Gulf Arabs and the Saudis. They've also managed to sort of find a common area of cooperation and do deals with them as well. And I think this, it just speaks to their pragmatism, their realpolitik, their understanding the sort of transactional nature, rather than sort of coming in saying, well, this is what we expect from you. You will do what we say. And both parties walking away from the table in disgust.
One of the things, as you describe all of that, one of the things that came up, that popped up in my mind is, you discussed, you know, these are chess players. This is a transactional way of conducting foreign policy versus, you know, an ideological way of conducting foreign policy, which is, you know, liberal democracy, human rights, etc. And I'm wondering if there's any way of bridging that gap, because I think as long as there is a schism, that you know, that there will always be tensions and risks.
There will, and you know, unfortunately, a lot of the mechanisms that were created to try and ensure that the dialogue remains ongoing, you know, they're no longer really fit for purpose. And, you know, if we're looking at sort of UN reform or the sort of IMF World Bank, you know, Russia and some of its sort of non-Western partners are trying to find alternative solutions to some of these things. You know, there's been, you know, the Indias and the Chinas or whatever, they've been very patient for a long period of time. They've been promised reforms that have never come. And I think they've got to a stage they're saying, right, we're going to create our own reality then. So I would hope that, you know, wiser heads will prevail on all sides. You know, without dialogue, then that's when things start getting very worrying. The there's a platform for dialogue in NATO, between the NATO and Russia. Mm. And that was frozen by NATO after the events in Crimea. Mm. There was absolutely zero contact. Mm. And you just think, with all the sort of military activity on both sides now in the Baltic and Eastern Europe, that's a very dangerous place to be.
You need that, yeah. You need those channels. You know,
mm-hmm. and those channels were active all the way through the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Suddenly to be put on hold is very concerning. The good news is that last year, 2016, that council did meet three times. I mean, I think everyone came away going, you know, we still have fundamental differences on all sides. Mm-hmm. But at least it seems that mechanism has been renewed, at least partially. Mm-hmm. But that's hugely important, whether it's the NATO-Russia Council, whether it's the UN Security Council, or any of these other international bodies.
Mm-hmm. I also, you know, I guess domestic politics informs international politics to an extent, and it is how is Russia society changing in terms of diversity, and I mean, is it in terms of other cultures being, you know, more or less welcomed? What's the situation like with immigration, things of that nature?
Yeah, so I think what a lot of people forget is that Russia and its precursors, sort of Soviet
Very diverse,
Union, Tsarist Russia,
yeah.
Yes, it's always been a massively multi-ethnic nation, just because of the size of the territory it covers, right? And I was reminded by this. I was up in St. Petersburg yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, slap bang in the middle of St. Petersburg, there's an enormous mosque, beautiful mosque, that was built in around 1911. Mm-hmm. You know, we still in Europe, there are some countries that are still having discussions today about whether to build mosques in cities.
The Swiss had their referendum on the minarets and things like
indeed.
This.
Indeed. So, you know, we sometimes forget this. The Minister of Defense is from a Buddhist republic. Mm-hmm. One of Mr. Putin's closest advisors for many years, Vladislav Surkov, he's half Chechen. Mm-hmm. You know, so we kind of forget. Obviously, the Russian ethnicity and culture is dominant. Mm-hmm. But I think the further you go out of the big Eastern Russian cities, the less that dominance prevails. So, you know, it's always been a multi-ethnic country. I'd say that's the first point. I'm not sure how much sort of more tolerant or diverse it's getting in sort of things like LGBT or those sort of issues. The attitude here has been, I think always, probably in Soviet times as well, has been, look, we know what goes on, you know, what goes on behind closed doors is your business. Mm-hmm. And we'll sort of stay out of that. You don't rub our noses in it, if you want to be sort of crude about it. So I don't think there's, apart from the big cities and the sort of youth and the sort of middle class intelligentsia who are exposed to Western values on their trips to the US or Europe or, you know, on their study or business trips, I think the most population don't get that exposure. So I don't think there is much sort of tolerance or the diversity agenda, if you want to put it that way. I don't think that is something that is sort of moving forward very quickly here. But, you know, the other thing, I mean, with sort of guest workers, there've been traditionally large numbers of guest workers from Central Asia and from the Caucasus. There are less now following the economic crisis, but you still see a lot. And I'll just give a sort of story. The streets, there are two main mosques in Moscow. And during the main Muslim holidays of sort of Ramadan and what's called Bayram, I think, Eid al-Bayram, so the streets around are shut down. Mm-hmm. And you have tens of thousands of people in the center of Moscow on main thoroughfares who are allowed to pray for their Muslim holidays. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure that happens in many European or American cities. Mm-hmm. I went down to a sort of delicatessen very close to the office during one of these holidays, and they had shut off the whole alcohol selling section. Mm. And there was a letter from the mayor's office saying, in respect of our, you know, and to honor our Muslim friends, colleagues, brothers, co-citizens, you know, all sales of alcohol will be banned from, you know, from this time to this time. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, again, that's a really positive gesture.
Yes.
That you wouldn't really see
in
sort of my home country, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not reported by sort of Western media, as you know, because it doesn't, I fear it doesn't really fit the narrative about what Russia is.
No. Yeah, that's, I think,
there are a lot of myths and misconceptions about Russia. So quite clearly. So this is really useful in terms of understanding what some of those are. What do you see? I guess two-sided question, but perhaps the sort of the biggest risk that Russia faces, and then secondly, in terms of the biggest opportunity that you think in terms of Western Russia relations at this point.
So I think the biggest risk is also its biggest sort of current benefit or bonus, and that is being so reliant on one man.
You know,
nobody really knows what would happen if suddenly that individual was no longer on the scene. No one knows. No one has a clue. There are no, as far as anyone knows, there are no mechanisms for transition. You know, it's sort of all bets are off.
Right.
And I'm sure that preys very heavily on his mind as well, to be honest with you. He's a very bright guy.
Is institution building occurring apace so that, you know, the institution can take over eventually with any change in power?
So some institutions are relatively well developed and independent. And, you know, I mean, the central bank has been receiving plaudits from all over. You know, from Western sort of interlocutors as well, about the way in which it's been able to manage this crisis, the economic crisis, for example. And I think there are others as well. I mean, the security services remain quite a strong sort of body. But, you know, there's within that sort of security services moniker, there's an awful lot of sort of sub units who are all sort of trying to, you know, gain their own influence, I suppose. So it's not clear, Ben. It's not clear entirely.
Okay.
And I think that remains the biggest point of potential vulnerability. I think the biggest opportunity, well, it's hard to talk about opportunities right now, to be honest with you, for European and American companies. There's an awful lot going on with the relationship with China and with Japan and with India and with the Middle East. And I think, you know, if sort of relations remain tense for much longer, then I think, you know, the West is potentially in danger of missing out in the long term.
Right. So do you think that Russia-Chinese relations are moving generally in a positive way?
They're definitely moving forward. They're definitely moving forward in a way that both Russia and China are pleased with, are satisfied with. You know, again, there's nobody sort of preaching values at each other. It's very transactional. It's very steely-eyed, I think, on both sides. A lot of the progress so far has been state to state, which isn't surprising given two heavily state-dominated economies. So a lot of that has not trickled down yet to sort of SMEs or sort of private business activity. But I think over time that will happen. You start to see now signs in Moscow in Russian and Chinese. You know, the vast numbers of tourists coming in now who didn't before from China. So I think it's starting to happen. You know, it's not an obvious replacement for the West. I mean, you know, Russia is, at the end of the day, a dominant sort of European society. So the obvious relationship is with sort of other European-style societies, given common history, sort of culture, society. And obviously China and Russia don't share that sort of common history. But it's happening. It's happening for sure. And I think it will continue to happen until relations get better with between Russia and the West.
And the world is changing very, very rapidly. And just as we started off the conversation, you know, who knows what might happen if we don't kind of explore the narrative under the surface a little bit. This has been fabulous, Tim. I really enjoyed this conversation. I want to be respectful of your time. But was there anything else that we didn't cover off about Russia that you'd like to let my listeners know or to raise at all?
Every time I've had friends or family come to visit, it's been with some reluctance that they've come initially, but they've always had their eyes open. I mean, they've always come away going, wow, I'm amazed. I had no idea. I think Russia is that kind of place. So I would really encourage, if you haven't been, to come and see it for yourself. Talk to people. People will talk very openly with you. You see for yourself the sort of infrastructural improvements that are happening. Come see some of the sort of the history, the museums, the amazing, incredible nature. It's an amazing, amazing country. Hmm. It remains quite sort of closed to the world, unfortunately. But I think if you come to see for yourself, you know, a lot of preconceived notions will vanish. So do, please. I'd encourage everyone to come and visit.
Very cool. Well, you've sold me, Tim. I'm very, very intrigued now. I guess before we go, if people want to know a little bit more about you or about Control Risks, your employer, where can they find you?
Sure. So controlrisks.com, I think, is our website. I'm on LinkedIn as well. What am I on LinkedIn? I think Tim B. Stanley or just Tim Stanley, something like that. But, you know, in Moscow, so relatively easy to find there. I'm relatively active on LinkedIn as well. So, or we're in Moscow. So, you know, if you do take up the offer to come and visit, let me know. I'd be happy to meet you for a coffee or a beer.
Absolutely. Tim, this has been fabulous. I really appreciate this. It's been very eye-opening. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Ben. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for the invitation.
All right. Bye for now.
So a huge spasibo, or thank you, to Tim for coming on the show and sharing his experiences and knowledge. I hope that you found it informative and interesting. And as always, check out the show notes. We've got all the links to the various things that we talked about in there. And, you know, I say this a lot, but I really would value your feedback on the show and certainly on this episode. You know, what do you think of Tim? What do you think of Russia? Is there a country that you would like to spend an extended period of time in? And how are you going to make that happen? And of course, any feedback that you have on the show would be extremely valued. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to send that. Check out allthingsrisk.co.uk as well. And you can find the different ways in which you can subscribe to the show. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. So the next episode will go out in 2 weeks. And, you know, don't worry, our back catalog is steadily growing. So next week might be a good opportunity for you to catch up on any episodes that you may have missed. So for now, I'm going to say do svidaniya. Goodbye. And we'll speak in 2 weeks. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.